I'm now speaking with Michael Collins-Dunn, who is the editor of the Middle East Journal, the oldest academic quarterly that deals with contemporary affairs in the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Collins-Dunn.
I'm glad to be here.
Already there seems to be some confusion because the president is saying, he just said today in Chile that he would basically, will soon transfer the U.S.'s leading role to others in NATO. But already there are divisions within NATO over whether or not that they want to be in charge of this operation.
That seems to be the case. I mean, Turkey is adamantly opposed, and the other allies that are participating are not doing so under a NATO command. They're doing so individually, Italy, Spain, France, the United Kingdom, et cetera. It seems to be a lot of confusion right now. I heard a report, I haven't seen the details, that Norway had even held back its aircraft because they're not quite sure what the command chain is. And I suspect there's a lot of confusion right now as to exactly who's in charge and who's calling the shots.
Well, somebody's calling. The shots are happening. I guess that's that's
somebody shooting. Yes.
Yes. So that's it's a little. I mean, I guess the broader issue really is that this is a very limited tactical goal that the UN or the UN mandate has offered up, which is to prevent civilian casualties at the hands of Gaddafi's forces. But the mere having crossed that line into warfare, there's tremendous strategic confusion about what's going on here, and there are all kinds of unknowns, as not to quote Rumsfeld, but do you have any idea of whether anybody really has a fix on what the goal is, or are they just responding to essentially a humanitarian crisis?
Well, I think to some extent they're responding to what was perceived as an immediate emergency. There have been calls to do something for a couple of weeks. And then suddenly, over the last several days, as Libyan forces, as the Gaddafi forces started pushing eastward, retook the oil ports, took Ajdabiya, and started pushing on Benghazi, we suddenly had this enormous pressure to don't just stand there, do something. And I think, you know, the immediate tactical response was to implement a no-fly zone and take out air defenses as a prelude to a no-fly zone. I'm not sure they've thought through what the next step is. And that can be dangerous because that's the sort of thing that can lead to mission creep, like classically in Somalia and so on. But I think that's the major worry, is do we have a step two, or is there a what do we do now after we have imposed a no-fly zone and gotten Libyan aircraft out of the sky? Then what? Or do we just keep flying an air umbrella indefinitely as a civil war rages down below?
Well, there are certain echoes of Iraq here, in as much as there were very limited objectives to get rid of Saddam Hussein, and they opened up all kinds of unforeseen strategic consequences, like Iran ends up basically being, you know, we ended up handing Iraq to Iran. Obviously, the strategic consequences aren't anywhere that grave in this case.
No. The biggest strategic consequence would be an open-ended commitment of some kind here, in which we can't withdraw without guaranteeing the destruction of the rebel force, and yet we lack the authority or the political will to intervene more openly. We've clearly said there aren't going to be any boots on the ground. Nobody else wants to commit to a land war in Libya either. We're already committed to two other wars. We haven't got the ability to go in with ground forces, so the question is, now what? You know, how open-ended is this? Do we just keep a no-fly zone in place forever? We kept one in place over northern Iraq from 1991 to 2003. Libya is four times as big as all of Iraq put together, not just the no-fly zones of Iraq. So that's a big, big commitment. And how are we going to do that? And I really think these are the questions that now somebody, I hope, is addressing. I sincerely hope.
Well, I suppose the assumption has been that this guy doesn't have a lot of support, which was evident by the rebellion that took over most of the country. But he was able to strike back with the only professional military that he ever allowed to be created, because he was concerned about a military coup. And that's controlled by his son, largely. And it doesn't seem like it's going to be such a big deal to degrade the Hamas brigade. So my suspicion here is that the only thing that makes any sense about this is if you would eliminate Gaddafi, then you would probably find that his whole support would collapse. And then rather than shoot at each other, the sides could negotiate some kind of a future as opposed to a civil war.
Well, I certainly agree that if somebody is able to eliminate Gaddafi, either whether acknowledging that that is their goal or not acknowledging that that is the goal, but doing so anyway, that would bring about a more rapid solution and a negotiable solution. The problem, of course, particularly if you're trying to do it with air power, is the same one we had with Saddam Hussein in Iraq. No matter how thoroughly we controlled the skies over Iraq, no matter how many times we bombed places we thought he was, we did not succeed in catching Saddam until quite a bit after we actually took Baghdad. And I suspect that, you know, Gaddafi has a lot of precautions in place to try to protect himself. He hasn't appeared in public except as a radio voice since this all started. And I certainly don't know where he is, but I also fear that our intelligence probably doesn't know precisely where he is either.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Collins Dunn, who is the editor of the Middle East Journal. And today, or tonight in Libya, there were large explosions in the compound, this vast compound that he has in Tripoli, which was attacked yesterday. And apparently, a building very close to the wrecked building that has been maintained as a symbol of Ronald Reagan's attack on Libya, right next to where apparently he has a tent where he receives foreign dignitaries. That was blown up. So it's very interesting, the confusion that's going on here. A British Ministry of Defense official said that there was indeed targeting of Gaddafi was on the table, and that prompted the Prime Minister to step forward and say that's not true. And the same thing's happened here with our defense spokespeople saying, no, it's not true. Somehow that doesn't ring true to me. What's your feeling that obviously that is not within the UN mandate?
It's not within the UN mandate, and therefore I don't think they will admit that it is a goal that we would not mind achieving. I doubt that we are at any point going to say that a decapitation strategy is our primary goal, both because it would make it far less likely that Gaddafi would consider any kind of stand down or retreat, but also because it just doesn't look real good in international affairs to say our primary goal is to assassinate a head of state. I suspect, however, that no one would shed a lot of tears if the brother leader were to die as a collateral damage from bombing the building next to his tent, for example, which probably is a legitimate military target. I rather doubt that we're going to explicitly state that we're trying to get him, but I don't think anybody would shed a lot of tears if he accidentally were under the bomb site.
And Michael Collins Dunn, you've studied the Egyptian military extensively, and there's always been an assumption that the boots on the ground that people keep talking about, one, we keep saying we're not going to do it. On the other hand, there's an expectation that the Libyan rebels need some kind of training, that they have no training and coordination and a kind of grab bag of arms. But I take it, though, that the Egyptians have their hand full. One, they're running a country that's just gone through a revolution. And two, they seem pretty leery of, I mean, I don't know, nobody's rushing forth, are they, to overtly try and get in there on the ground?
Not at all. The Arab League, of course, supported the no-fly zone, but has been very, very cautious about committing any kind of military force. I don't think they want to be perceived as seeing Arab militaries actually engaged in combat. Egypt fought a brief war with Libya back in 1977, but you know that's distant memory now. Egypt, I think, is the only obvious source for major ground forces, and I don't really think that's coming. As you said, the Egyptian army is preoccupied with running the country. They're trying to oversee a transition to. They just had the constitutional referendum over the weekend. They're going into a major transition, trying to transfer power to a newly elected government by this fall, which is a fairly short timetable. They don't have time to fight a major war. Now, I do think the Egyptian military is already supplying arms to the rebels, and probably, I mean, there have been reports of this, I can't confirm it, and probably Egyptian special forces or advisors of some sort are in there trying to train the rebels. We know that the British SAS was in there. I suspect many Western and Arab countries do have some special forces and special operations people operating in eastern Libya, but that's a far cry from sending infantry formations across the border, which I don't expect to happen.
And it's also would indicate that if there were plans or expectations to assassinate Gaddafi, it would be even if teams were in Tripoli, there's a lag time between the time you spot the guy till the time the cruise missiles arrive. So I wonder if that's also going on.
I would say you can speculate that it may be, but I would also say that, you know, I don't know. I don't have any particular knowledge of the fact that it is, but it would not.
Well, the reason these questions come up are the obvious ones, which is, what's the end game? I mean, the Congress is asking these questions. The Chairman of the Joint Chiefs said that the end game was uncertain. Senator Lugar is now calling for a declaration of war, which, of course, hasn't happened for since World War II, I think.
I think you're right.
The worst outcome would be a divided country and a continued civil war. Well, the oil field's right between the warring factions, and there is an assumption that this regime is pretty weak and rotten from within. So I'm wondering, do you have any knowledge of the inner circle? I mean, would not surprise me if some of the members of the inner circle were kind of disgusted with these spoiled brat sons who've and this crazy leader who's plundered the country.
Well, most of the inner circle are his relatives and his fellow tribesmen anyway. You know, this is the problem. They're all kin, and it's been a long time since he's had very many of his original free officer military allies from 1969 in his inner circle. The inner circle is mostly his relatives. So I would say that, you know, it's a close, tight-knit inner circle. But the big question is, as you say, the son commands a brigade. It's an elite brigade, but is the rest of the army loyal, or is there going to come a point at which the rest of the army starts to defect en masse, as the army in the east already has pretty much done, as we have seen the army be the decisive factor in pushing out the presidents in Tunisia and in Egypt, and it looks, as I know you're going to talk about Yemen next, as if that's what's beginning to happen in Yemen, with the army leadership bailing out on the president rather quickly. I think that that's the question, and I'm not sure that anybody, even the major Western intelligence agencies, has a very clear answer about what the opinions within the rest of the military leadership, outside of those who are his immediate family, may be. But that's the crucial question, as you say. If that doesn't happen, this becomes a long-term civil war with the coalition providing an air umbrella over a divided Libya.
So if it's going to have that unpleasant result, then I guess we have to assume that the president took this decision difficult. It was difficult to take the decision. It was entirely based upon immediate humanitarian concerns, and they just simply couldn't think any further, which I find hard to believe. That's, again, I come back to what seems to be logical, is that they must at some point must have some determination to get rid of Gaddafi. Otherwise, this whole operation doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, I think it's clear, and the president has been saying for a couple of weeks now that Gaddafi's asked to go. He's lost the support of his own people. The problem is we don't have an authorization from the United Nations to get rid of Gaddafi. If we did, I'm sure that would be more explicitly what we were trying to do. I certainly think the implied assumption here, not just for us, but for most of the participants in these attacks, is that we want to get rid of Gaddafi. But you can't get the United Nations to support that. You're not going to get the Arab League probably to support that, because if they start calling for the removal of an Arab dictator, you don't know where that stops. You know, and the Arab League is trying to protect their own jobs too. So I suspect nobody's going to say that that's the real goal, but it's the only possible strategic endgame you can come up with, is that this has to result in removing Gaddafi. Otherwise, you do end up with a long-term stalemate. That's a very unsatisfactory for Libya and very unsatisfactory for the coalition forces involved. And there's no easy way out other than getting rid of Gaddafi. So even if that's not the explicit goal, I think it's the implied goal, and it may have to become the explicit goal at some point, because otherwise there's no obvious way out.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Michael Collins-Dunn.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Collins-Dunn, editor of the Middle East Journal, the oldest academic quarterly that deals with contemporary affairs in the Middle East.